It's gone by in the blink of an eye. We enter round five of pool stages today at Rugby World Cup 2023. And it feels like just the other day that France and New Zealand were in their tournament opener. And yeah, geez, it's really just gone by 5 weeks. The Box obviously not playing this week. Herman Mostert joins us in the Cape Town studios. This is the Inside Pass, News 24's dedicated daily Rugby World Cup podcast. Morning, Herman.
Morning, Lloyd. How are you?
Back in the saddle today. Did you miss us?
A little bit, yes.
Welcome back. I mean, it really has gone by quickly. I mean, there's been so much rugby. Obviously, little breaks in between, you know, when the teams aren't playing. But, geez, so much rugby over the weekends. And it's hard to think that we're already on the verge of the quarterfinals.
Yeah, there's obviously, I would like to have seen more midweek matches. It sort of feels like there's an avalanche of games on the weekends and then not a lot in the week. If you look at the Soccer World Cup or the Cricket World Cup that's starting today, the matches are more panned out, you know. So, but on the weekend, there's certainly no shortage of games. And yeah, we're going to see that again this weekend.
Tough scheduling, I guess, to make sure in a sport like rugby to give guys a rest. As we said, the Box not playing this weekend, but still very interested in what transpires. The main event, obviously, Ireland and Scotland in a game that means everything to the Springboks in terms of where they'll finish. We'll talk about that a little bit later on to close today's show. But I wanted to talk today about some of the other stories that have developed in Rugby World Cup 2023 that are quite special. And, you know, Fiji this weekend, for example, you know, their date with destiny, they wrap up the pool stages, play Portugal in the final match of the weekend, need one bonus point to qualify for the quarters ahead of Australia in what is surely one of the stories and upsets of Rugby World Cup 2023. I mean, what have you made of them so far? I mean, their performance against the Wallabies was just, you know, superb, and deservedly have put themselves into a position where they can now, you know, create history once more by making a quarterfinal. Very impressed by them.
Yes, definitely. Ever since that game against Wales where it looked like they would be losing comfortably, and then they went and scored three tries right at the end and almost ended up beating Wales. Only a last pass that went out or was knocked on at the end that cost them that match. And then obviously they backed that performance against Wales, or that late charge against Wales, they backed that up with a win over Australia. Obviously the Wallabies, probably the worst Wallabies team in history. But still, Fiji have performed really well, and it's sort of reminiscent of the 2007 Fijian team that, if you'll recall, almost knocked the Box, or they almost shocked the Box in the quarterfinals. I think the scores were level after 60 minutes in that game. And then they gave the Springboks a massive fright. So this team sort of reminds me a bit of that 2007 team, you know. And I can't see them losing to Portugal. They almost slipped up against Georgia, where, you know, Georgia is also a very physical game, a team that plays a sort of an attritional type of game. And they got through that. They trailed 9-0 at halftime and got through that match. So I don't see them, you know, even if they lose to Portugal, they at least get a bonus point, which would put them ahead of Australia because they beat Australia head-to-head.
So would think they'll get at least four tries in that game as well.
That'll obviously probably be their first objective. But, I mean, they should beat Portugal comfortably. And then if they make the quarters, then they could, I think it's possibly England in the quarters that they could play. So, I mean, they beat England at Twickenham, you know, just a few weeks before the tournament. So who knows, you know, the sky's the limit for them.
Yeah, geez, Fiji in the semi-finals of Rugby World Cup would be quite something. Obviously, that heartbreaking story coming out of their camp with Joshua Tuisova, you know, tragically losing his 7-year-old son, and he's missing that funeral to stay on to play the Portugal game, which is kind of just an indication of how much this all means to these guys that are over there. I mean, you know, the thought of Fiji breaking ground and making a semi-final would be very, very special indeed. The other one, obviously, that's quite tasty is Japan, who are up against Argentina, which is what essentially a last 16 shootout for a quarterfinal spot. And Japan have kind of just flown under the radar a bit, you know, over the course of the tournament. I think probably Argentina haven't quite hit their straps, and you know, perhaps that's why Japan now with a bit of an opportunity. But you know, also just a magical rugby nation. If you look at what, you know, they've achieved every World Cup that they've played. In 2015, there was the Brighton, you know, miracle where they stunned the Springboks. And Eddie Jones was obviously had a lot to say about that. And 2019, they had a superb World Cup at home as well. And now 2023, 4 years later, probably haven't taken the strides they would have expected or hoped to have taken on the international stage since 2019. But if you knock over Argentina and get yourself into another Rugby World Cup quarterfinal, then that's you know, another case of job done.
Yeah, there's almost this perception that the Japan team isn't as good as they were 4 years ago. Obviously, when 4 years they beat Scotland and Ireland in the pool stages, which was, I guess, a shock at the time, although they were hosting the World Cup back then. But they've actually gone about their business quietly and relatively comfortably. I mean, they've got a very good coach in Jamie Joseph. They've even got a few South Africans again in their lineup, as almost always seems to be the case, and obviously a few South Sea Island players as well. But they, you know, they'll fancy their chances against Argentina. You know, the Pumas haven't been that good. They certainly haven't been a consistent team over the last couple of years. And we saw that in that the horrible performance they had against England when they couldn't even compete against 14 England players. For the whole, England had a red card early in that game, and it was a really poor performance from Argentina. So I think Japan will favour them. I wouldn't say favour themselves, but they'll back themselves to have a chance of upsetting Argentina. And I think it could potentially be obviously the Ireland Scotland game is going to be a big game, but that could also, you know, maybe be a dark horse for contender of match of the weekend. Who knows?
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the smaller nations at the World Cup this year, because, you know, it's been quite a hot topic of conversation. We've seen some, you know, landslide results over the course of the pool stages, you know, particularly Namibia struggling. Obviously, Italy, who you wouldn't quite consider a minnow nation, but on the receiving end of a big one against the All Blacks. You know, a couple of other, you know, just really big results that were difficult to watch at times. I mean, what do you make of that? You know, it's that balancing act that World Rugby has of needing to grow the game, but also to keep, you know, World Cup rugby competitive.
Yeah, it's a tough one, because obviously you'd like to see a bit of more of strength versus strength. Obviously those games generate more interest. It almost makes one think that maybe they should go back to the 16 team tournament, where you've got four pools of four teams, which was the case, I think, 95 when it was hosted here in South Africa. That was the last time it was 16 teams.
Yeah,
maybe that could be an argument. But then again, when you mention of growing the game, and you know, obviously rugby compared to other sports around the world is not that big a sport, actually, you know. So then it's tough to argue to say, listen, you must now cut the amount of teams. We see with the Cricket World Cup starting today, there are only 10 teams now in the Cricket World Cup. In years gone by, there used to be more, and it used to be a pool stage. This thing is now like a league competition, basically. All the teams play all the teams, and then just got semi-finals. That for me isn't really a World Cup. It's like a league, you know, a league that you play. So I don't think rugby will go that route. I mean, that is not going to grow the popularity of the game globally. You know, obviously there's a World Cup in America lying in wait as well.
Yeah,
a Rugby World Cup. So I think it's a case of, you know, finding other ways to get these smaller nations being more battle hardened for Rugby World Cups. You know, they have to play more matches against the bigger teams outside of the World Cups. You know, an example is a team like Tonga. You know, they a lot of people punted them up as a potential threat for the Springboks' Pool B, obviously with Ireland and Scotland also in that pool, and Tonga basically lost all three of those games pretty comfortably.
Yeah.
Yes, they talk about it, Tongans being very physical, and it's a bruising game, but if you look at the results, they lost fairly convincingly all three of those games. Mm. But then again, go look at what Tonga did before the World Cup. They hardly played any matches,
yeah, you know, exactly.
Again, especially not against top tier nations. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's something that they have to look at.
But how do you do that? Because, you know, the rugby calendar is so congested at the moment with the various club competitions going on around, European competitions. The URC is a long tournament. You know, Super Rugby is happening at the same time. You've got lucrative leagues in Japan and elsewhere. You know, there's not an awful lot of, you know, international window to accommodate series like that, you know, to give a Tonga and a Georgia and a Samoa, you know, cracks against some of the bigger nations. You know, you've got Rugby Championship that has to be hosted. You've got Six Nations that has to be hosted. I mean, it's very difficult to kind of find the time, really, in a calendar year to host games like this.
Yeah, I think there is maybe scope for, and there have been talks in the past, but nothing confirmed, that maybe the Rugby Championship could be expanded to have a few more teams involved. You know, there have been talks about Japan maybe joining, but there could be talks about maybe getting Tonga, Samoa and Fiji in that tournament, or maybe bringing back that old Pacific Nations. Remember a few years back, they had a very strong team that played tests against the Springboks, the All Blacks and the Wallabies. Maybe that could be looked as an example.
Yeah.
And there's quotes just coming in today from the English Rugby Football Union Chief Executive Bill Sweeney, confirming that they are busy with negotiations regarding a Nations Cup in the future. Obviously, that's a tournament that has been talked about over the last couple of years now. It's been punted, and now he's basically confirming it's not, the tournament hasn't been confirmed yet, but he's confirmed that they are in talks regarding such a tournament, and that would give the smaller nations the option of playing more regularly against bigger opponents. At the moment, it looks like a two-tier competition, 12 teams in the top division and 12 teams in the bottom division. Even if you've got 12 teams in the top division, that still means a lot of those so-called smaller, lesser teams would still be playing in the top division. So then they would obviously get the chance to play more against the bigger teams. And then there would be the incentive for an even weaker team to get into the promotion relegation factor and maybe get into the top. So,
and what's so important about those fixtures is that they actually mean something. You know, it's not an exhibition game. If you think of the Georgia team that came to South Africa, and we were talking about it earlier, but the first match post-COVID for South Africa, you know, I mean, that's a kind of two-match series, and it's, you know, there's not an awful lot riding on those games results-wise for either side. But in a Nations Cup-type setting, when there's promotion and relegation on the line, all of a sudden, every game that these minnow sides are playing is worth a hell of a lot. So, you know, by the time you get to a Rugby World Cup, should you qualify, you're quite used to, you know, kind of, you know, league points, competitive tournament rugby, which I think would be helpful. Do you think there's any argument to be made for two tiers at a Rugby World Cup? I've heard that theory thrown around a little bit in the last couple of weeks, you know, potentially having, I don't know what, you know, 10 teams in a top tier and 10 in a bottom, or an 8-8 split, you know, but kind of keeping the top teams all playing against each other more regularly, and then the second half, you know, the lower ranked sides are all pooled in the same half of the draw and they play each other. And then when you get into knockouts, you know, the two best placed teams in the lower half will, you know, maybe into the quarterfinals or something like that. But do you think there's...
Well, it's a tough question, I guess, to answer. You know, you'd have to play the two, so almost call it two tournaments concurrently.
Yeah.
And the interest, you know, there is a supply and demand issue, and monetary issues do come into play. I don't think there would be an awful lot of interest in people buying tickets to watch those two, you know, the minnows play each other. You know, they'd obviously rather want to see the real deal. But there is an argument to be said. You know, in South Africa, for instance, years back, there was a policy where you had the Currie Cup here, and you had the A division and the B division, and there was sort of an incentive, which probably in a lot of people's minds wasn't that fair, that the winner of the B section had the opportunity to come straight into the semifinals of the Currie Cup proper. And there was a scenario way back in the 80s where the Sharks, or Natal as they were called then, shocked Free State in the semifinals, and they actually made it all the way to the Currie Cup final, and they played against Western Province and actually led at halftime. But anyhow, that could be a solution where you have that tournament, and then maybe give the incentive of saying that the winner of that B or second tier division getting a quarterfinal place at the Rugby World Cup. But I just don't see it happening from a monetary perspective and purely because of a supply-demand thing. Like, I don't think there would be that much interest in it.
Mm.
I don't think you'd be able to sell stadiums out. I mean, we've seen now even, which is strange, the Cricket World Cup starting. I mean, it's an empty stadium now for the opening match.
The Oaks are working, but they're still coming.
So yeah, it is something worth discussing, but I don't really see it panning out ever.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, if you look at the results in the tournament so far, you know, you're probably actually being a bit harsh because yes, there have been the landslide victories, but there have also been some very encouraging performances from some of the smaller teams as well. And if you look at it, it's really just Romania and Namibia that have taken the really big numbers. And yes, Italy took that big one against the All Blacks. But, you know, if you look at Uruguay, for example, who play the All Blacks tonight, I mean, that France game, you know, when France put their B team out, I think it was Uruguay's first game of the tournament, and, you know, they were 13-12 down with 25 minutes to play in that game, Uruguay, and then the Fly-off kicked the ball into his own player's head, and they went down. They went down a try, ended up losing 27-12, but, I mean, against a French team that's, you know, considered one of the favourites to win this tournament, for a nation like Uruguay to come out with a 15-point defeat against a title contender was a very good performance. You know, we saw Chile losing 43-10 to Samoa. Yeah, look, big result. But, you know, not hardly embarrassing. You know, we saw Wales beating Portugal 28-8, Portugal, you know, hanging in there and, you know, giving a good account to themselves.
That scoreline actually flattered Wales a bit.
Yeah, Wales were awful that day. And then Portugal got their draw against Georgia, who are hardly a giant of the game for sure, but, you know, have been around for a long time. So, you know, Argentina beating Samoa 19-10, that one was tight. You know, there've been those games where even Uruguay and Namibia, you know, the two kind of middle nations playing against each other was a highly entertaining game of rugby. My point is that you kind of got to go into them, give them the opportunity to play, give them the opportunity to experience this World Cup. Hope that, you know, my concern with these things is always the injuries, you know, because you get guys at such different levels of, you know, physical conditioning. I mean, if you've got guys who have full-time jobs, you know, who are then taking time off work to come and play World Cup rugby against conditioned professional athletes, that's always my worry, that you're going to get something bad that happens in that space. But, I mean, if you avoid that, then I think we can all, you know, also through the odd landslide victory, but, you know, see the broader benefits of it all. I mean, Japan have done it, Haman. I mean, if you look at where Japan were in years past and that progression, you know, and that came from being exposed to these big, you know, teams. I mean, that 95 game, what did they lose in that one?
Well, they lost 145-17 to New Zealand in 95, and 20 years later they beat the Springboks. So I think that match will always be the benchmark for the Minnows. Something that they can look up to and say, listen, it has been done before.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that obviously was a massive shock. Probably the biggest shock in world rugby history, you can call it. But yeah, so there's always that little bit of hope that those teams can play for. And, you know, we've seen with Uruguay in that France game, you know, that if the ball bounced a little bit better for them, they could have actually been ahead.
Yeah.
Leading France with like 15 minutes to go. And then, you know, that opening win against the All Blacks wouldn't mean much for the French, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, look at, I guess that's why it's called the World Cup. You know, you can't, it's not a tournament that, an exclusive tournament that just has eight teams, you know, it's a tournament that drags in teams from all across the world. That's why you've got these qualification blocks, if you can call it, on certain parts of the world. Obviously, you've got in Oceania, you've got the island teams, and then you've got your Americas, and obviously maybe there's a case for trying to maybe get another African spot. There's obviously a lot of African nations, and every time, bar 1995, when the Ivory Coast actually shocked Namibia just before that World Cup to qualify for that event, it's always been Namibia. You know, like, apart from South Africa, obviously, Namibia is by far and away the best African team for a long time now. And then obviously when they get to the World Cup, they don't really look like they can compete. They've never won a match at a World Cup, but they seem to qualify very easily for that. So, but yeah, look, there are, there's, I mean, that's why it's called the World Cup. You know, these guys, they want to be on this. It happens once every 4 years. It's not an annual thing. So
yeah,
that's why it's there for, you know, it's the scope for that.
Keep it the way it is. It has the international flavor. It's it's nice to, as a guy, you know, as guys who are exposed to rugby all year round, it's nice to see a different side of the game every so often. The other point, obviously, is that, you know, it's more than just the results for some of these guys as well. I mean, I heard heard commentators on the broadcast a few times refer to the fact that for a lot of these players, you know, every outing at a Rugby World Cup is essentially an audition and an opportunity for these guys to make a statement and potentially land a contract or a deal at a club in Europe or Japan that could potentially change their lives. So there's that to consider as well. You know, as much as it's about the nations being exposed, it's also a huge opportunity for individual players who devoted their lives to this game. I want to just talk before we go, just briefly, we'll talk about it more you know, as we head into the weekend. But Ireland, Scotland, and the qualification permutations, because we haven't had you on the show for a couple of days. But from your side, Herman, I mean, no concerns at all. I mean, mathematically still possible for the Box to miss out on a quarterfinal spot, but I mean, realistically, it's hard to see that happening.
No, it's not going to happen. Like, it's Scotland aren't even going to try and beat Ireland by 21 points. I mean, Ireland are the number one team in the world. They've had it over Scotland in the recent times. I don't think Scotland can prepare for a match like that, saying we need to score 4 tries and we need to beat them by 21 points. It just wouldn't be realistic. Like, the way you set your whole game up, you would have to play a risky game. You'd have to go out of your comfort zone. You'd have to go out of what you normally do. And then what then happens is then you take risks and then it all falls apart. And then they end up losing by 21 points. Mm. So Scotland's main objective should be, and I'm assuming it would be, to beat Ireland by 8 points. And that would mean that, like, a 2012 victory. That would be a realistic benchmark or realistic goal for them to set.
Yeah.
And what that would obviously mean is Ireland would get 0 points and they'd stay on 14. Scotland would go to 14. Scotland don't have to score 4 tries. They just need to beat Ireland, but make sure Ireland gets 0 points. Then South Africa would win that group. Scotland would be second because they knock Ireland out because they won the match between them. That would be a more realistic goal for them to achieve. If not, then they're not going to get through.
Mm.
And South Africa, yeah, so the only way the Box can get out is if Scotland win by 21 or more points and score 4 tries, but then Ireland also need to score 4 tries. They also need to get a bonus point, and that would obviously see Scotland then win the group because their points differential would be best. But then the rules change again. Then to determine teams 2 and 3, it goes to head to head, and because Ireland beat the Springboks, but it's not. It'll be, like Jock Nienaber said, it'll probably be match fixing if that was to happen.
Scotland 50, Ireland 28, something like that puts the Box out. So we can all.
So a few guys
easy.
Might be investigated for irregular activities which might end their careers in any case.
Thanks, Herman. Our walking, talking rugby encyclopedia, Herman Mostert, with us in the Cape Town studios. We'll leave it there. Pool action obviously resumes this evening with the All Blacks taking on Uruguay. Jeez, the All Blacks, since that France game, have cantered through this pool. And they might be quite cold come the quarterfinals, given that they've had their big game in week one. But we'll be back tomorrow morning, building up to the weekend, looking back on what happens in that game tonight. This has been the Inside Pass. Thank you very much for joining us. Cheers.